It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll find out why reading and math test scores are stagnating for high school seniors.
First, every year, the Wisconsin Academy of Science, Arts, and Letters quarterly magazine, Wisconsin People and Ideas, holds a contest to showcase the works of emerging writers in Wisconsin.
The contest is divided into fiction and poetry categories, and this year's judges went through 585 poems and 69 fiction submissions before declaring the winners.
And we've got the first place winners from each category with us today. Fiction winner Karen Loeb is a professor of creative writing and literature at UW-Eau Claire. Karen, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
And we have the winner in the poetry category, Dion Kempthorne, writer and UW professor emeritus. He lives in the woods of Richland County. Dion, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, I want to start with Karen. Your winning story, The Walk to Makino, takes place in a neighborhood in Japan. Can you give us some of the background, the inspiration behind writing it?
Sure. A lot of my fiction is driven by geography, and Chicago has often been a backdrop. Florida has often been a backdrop, and I spent two separate residencies in Japan with my husband, teaching on an exchange program, and my father came to visit us, and from that grew the story. Although I fictionalized the events in the story, it is based on the relationship that I had with my own father, a kind of difficult relationship, as parent-children relationships often are, and it explores that relationship. The father and daughter in the story don't know each other very well, and the daughter isn't aware that the father is declining mentally until he actually is in her house and experiences his fears that don't really seem rational anymore.
And one of the things that struck me reading the story is a fleeting chance moment that leads to the father talking about the daughter's childhood. What is it about those little fleeting moments that can maybe make that connection that isn't always sparked otherwise?
Right. And I think you're talking about when they look into the bar and they see the cat nursing the kittens, and then the father makes a comment about Rachel, the daughter, when she was an infant. And she is struck by that because he never really talked about her childhood before, and he's not willing to go back there once she brings it up again. And it's like he's closed the chapter on that family when he left the family. And so, yes, a moment like that can provide an opening, but the door closes, at least in her case and in his case, closes almost as fast as it opens.
It's such a unique moment in a way, but it feels universal. I remember my late grandfather who never talked about his experience in World War II. And one night, nobody had any idea what triggered it. He talked to us for about an hour about it. And then that was it. I think that's something that every family can feel in a relationship with someone. There's maybe that one time where we had that open door.
Right. Yeah, I agree. So, yeah, he won't go back there. Mm-hmm. He volunteers in the story some information about her mother, but the father and mother have been divorced for many, many years, so she just can't pry any more information out of him after that.
And can you share a brief passage from your story if you have something?
Sure. I've got a 30-second and a 1 minute. Which would you prefer?
I still want to get to our poet, so if you've got the 30-second handy, that would be great. Yeah.
So the father and daughter are walking to a store. That's the main action of the story. And they, in the store, they're buying whole wheat bread, and this is a conversation. "The slices are too thick," her father says. "That's how they are, double-sized. I usually slice them in half." She gives two loaves to her father, and she carries two to the checkout. "There are only 5 slices in this bag, Rachel." "It's okay, Dad. I'll make them into 10 when we get home. Maybe they have another brand with thinner slices." "That's it, Dad. That's what they have." And it just kind of, it's just a very small moment in the story, and the father, but it shows the father struggling with being in a place that he's not used to, and that's what I can do in 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for giving us that taste of the story. That was Karen Loeb reading from her award-winning story in the fiction category in this statewide writing contest we're talking about. Let's turn to the poetry category now with Dion Kempthorne. Dion, your poem is Liturgy of the Swallow. I, in a way, hate to ask what a poem is about. I'll ask you to read from it in a minute. But what is your poem about? What is it tackling?
Well, I think in general, I mean, on the surface, it's about observing a bird in church. Mm. And one can draw from the observation of the bird what some of the sentiment of the poem is. So it's full of wordplay, as it were, and birdplay. But in terms of theme, I think the general appeal of the poem, should it have one, is the appeal to everyone who's ever felt like they are trapped in a situation, not necessarily in a church with any concerns for religion, but perhaps in a lecture hall where Dion Kempthorne is talking too long with his poem, or perhaps on a job, or perhaps in a bad marriage, or perhaps in an MRI machine. So I think it's a poem about flight, and in some ways about ascension, and about the human need, whether it's in the NASA space program or in our stargazing in the evenings or are just looking up for some kind of salvation. It's about the flight of the bird impressing us in his effort to escape the contraption of the human building and civilization with his natural flight. But I could read it.
And Dion, yeah, I was going to say, could you please read Liturgy of the Swallow to us?
This takes about exactly 1 minute, I think, Rob.
Okay.
You may remember the one-minute Shakespeare program.
I do.
This will be your one-minute church. You'll be good for the week. Liturgy of the Swallow. While Cardinal Swanson flares his satin sleeves on high to let fly the word of God, the little bird, swift and sweet as a stolen kiss, having lost its way in, seeking a way out, tries flying some dazzling demonstrations of flight above the heads of a gaping congregation, dives way down to sway a swerving choir, swoops way up to light on the barbed brow of Jesus, pauses there to perch a parable on the virtues of an open window, then sets off on a mission of light and thuds like a Bible into a muddled rainbow of leaded glass, drops as dead, but dangles from the sill, then flutters up to cling to a leaded seam of sky, and hangs there faintly, pecking at the pane of Sebastian, its sleek wings drawn in, its forked tail trembling, in back a baby crying.
And Dion, I always wonder, with poetry or many other forms of artistic creation, how much do you want people to get your meaning here, and how much do you want them to take it and interpret it, as you say, in ways that they may have felt trapped in their lives?
My feeling is that a good poem really is open to interpretation, and I don't begin with an intent for a meaning so much as an image, something that's caught my eye. It might be a bird in church, or a dog tied to a parking meter, or an overheard conversation at the Quick Trip. So I think the poem, if it's good, has a broad application and should have many implications, I think.
Well, Dion, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, you're most welcome. Thank you.
And Karen Loeb, thanks to you as well.
Thank you so much.
So a poem with a flying bird and a story that starts with a flight of a father from the United States to Japan. We've been hearing from the winners of this year's Wisconsin People and Ideas Fiction and Poetry Contest, Karen Loeb, with her story winning in the fiction category, Dion Kempthorne on the poetry side.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, predictions of a massive escalation of youth crime back in the 1990s never came true. The Retro Report looks back at the rise and fall of the super predator.
First, we take a look at some national education news, as well as some happenings right here in Wisconsin. The latest test results from the National Assessment of Educational Progress show that in recent years, high school seniors have failed to improve in the areas of math and reading, and that's causing some concern.
And in Wisconsin, an assembly task force researching the state's rural schools recommends more funding for those schools and a change to the state's funding formula.
Joining us now to talk about these stories is Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Education at St. Norbert College. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, very glad to be here.
Well, so according to the nation's report card, as it's known, America's high school seniors have shown no improvement in their math and reading abilities since the last time the test was administered. How worried should we be about this?
Well, I think first it's important to look at what the NAEP is. And the NAEP has been around since about the late 1960s. And now, since the 80s, it's given about every other year. And they alternate with math, reading, science, writing, civics, and history, even on occasion. And it provides a little snapshot, a very valid, reliable, and trustworthy snapshot of performance of students K-12 in the United States. So it's a very respected instrument. And so when people talk about it, they should feel confident that it really does provide, say, a really nice view, brief, but a really brief, nice view of what's going on in the country. What we've found in about the last 8 or 9 years is high school scores are becoming increasingly stable. If you are a more positive spinner, if you're not a positive spinner, you might call them static or not improving. It sort of depends on your perspective. If we all remember what Mark Twain said about statistics, lies, damn lies, and statistics, people will spin this lots of different ways. But the bottom line on this is the scores for high school students have not changed in any statistically significant way for almost a decade.
Yeah, that seems like a long time. We were trying to move the needle here on these scores. So as someone who studies education, how would you digest what this means? Does this mean it's time to throw everything out, go back to the drawing board, and look afresh, maybe institute some new policies and new methods of teaching? Or do we need to sort of relax, take a deep breath, and stay the course for a while?
Well, relaxing and taking a deep breath is never a bad idea. but this has been a neat topic of discussion in the introduction to education classes that I teach too, because we've been looking over this, and I had a student that offered a really interesting perspective I hadn't considered, and since then I've read a few others. With we now have a high school graduation rate, depending on who you talk to, whether it's Secretary Duncan or a superintendent in a state, but our high school graduation rates are going up. Now, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. We want students to graduate from high school. But the student shared that he had just read the book Freakonomics, and he was then thinking, hey, you know, maybe everybody graduating from high school is a good thing, but maybe those students don't do as well as others did, and maybe we have more students that aren't performing as highly as they used to. We used to eliminate those students. And so I thought that was an interesting sort of Freakonomics look at it, that the students were getting to stay aren't those that have historically performed well. They used to be gone.
So obviously, you know, we want students to graduate from high school. That's the point of, in many ways, public education, getting kids to graduate from high school, maybe go on to college or technical school or something like that. But getting that high school degree under their belts is huge. So you're saying, you know, by the logic that more kids staying in high school, it could be something that could lower test scores, but overall, a good thing.
It's an interesting sort of way to look at it. It's our students that have always performed highly, they've always been in high school. And students that have been in middle performing, they've always relatively stayed at high school. Students drop out for lots and lots of reasons, not necessarily academic performance. But as we increase graduation rates, we certainly are retaining students that may or may not be academically strong. Now, I don't know the size of that effect, but certainly that has to be part of it. Other people attribute the static scores to a lack of motivation for high school students. The evidence on that is really, really thin, but you will read that. I believe, likely, it also has to deal with, now, here's an interesting one for people listening to really start to think about. In the next 2 to 4 years, evidence indicates that more than 50% of our high school students across the country will be non-white. Now, we do know that students of color do have academic challenges, especially with standardized testing, which means the system we have in place that have served Anglo students during the previous 100 years, perhaps it's time to be able to look at the delivery and the instructional methods we use, because as any educator out there listening knows, it is not one size fits all. So you probably have a constellation of issues at hand. And if we want to move this up, you're probably looking at changing some of the delivery models and a whole variety of things to be able to bring about, again, increased changes at that high school level.
So you're talking about demographic shifts in America. You're talking about kids staying in high school till they graduate, some different factors. It's a nuanced look at what this test has revealed, the snapshot. Do you think that what you've said here is going to be enough to the people at the top of the pyramid who are looking at education and education policy and might be worried at these results?
Oh, and anybody that's interested in this, it is so fascinating, the political perspectives that people are taking. Conservative groups, interestingly, American Enterprise Institute, those type of groups, are coming out saying now that the NAEP scores aren't really important because the liberals are then going to argue that to increase the NAEP scores, we need to increase early childhood education even more and more funding for K-12. And they would argue that, again, that 9th and 10th Amendment issue, that they should stay out of it. And then they are also arguing that some of the liberal groups are saying we do need to increase funding and we do need to increase our influence on student performance. Oh, you know, everything from Head Start to college loans to et cetera, et cetera. And government can have a bigger role in improving these overall performances. So the political groups, boy, they have jumped on with both feet and they are going for a ride.
Well, if, as you say, we should take a look at some of these other trends that aren't strictly taking place, you know, inside the classroom. It's not just about what happens in the classroom, these scores. Then I guess what action should we take? How should we view these scores? Is it something that, you know, we can say, well, they didn't fall, they're stagnant, but given what we know about shifting demographics, et cetera, that maybe it's okay to just keep on the way we're going?
Well, and I think first we have to remember that NAEP scores move very, very slowly. So if anybody's proposing to you a get-rich-quick scheme or you can lose 20 pounds in a week, run away. And if anybody's proposing they can move the NAEP scores really, really fast, run away faster. It doesn't happen that way. But we do know that the NAEP scores are going up in younger grades. So there are more successful strategies going on there. Now, whether or not those are generalizable to as students age, that's a good question. We do know also that African American students are underperforming and continue to underperform relative to both Latino and Anglo students. So this is, again, this is not this one size fits all. And so schools are going to have to be able to look at these groups that are not doing well and target them with much more,
and boy, I hate to sound like a presidential press conference, what much more laser-like precision, because it's not one size that fits all. So the demands on teachers and infrastructures are going to change if we want to be able to get these groups this opportunity for performance improved among these groups that are not doing well and are static. So
we're talking right now with Steve Correa about some of the latest education news, including the news that high school seniors have not improved in the areas of math and reading, according to the nation's report card. And we want to know how concerned you are. What do you think about some of the reasoning here? And what do you think? Do we need to target specific groups of students? As Steve Correa was saying, how worried are you? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up that conversation after this look at the news. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We pick up our conversation with Steve Correa now about reading and math scores, as well as some news about rural schools in the state. And you can join the conversation right now, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, talking about the NAEP scores, about stagnating reading and math scores nationally for high school seniors and what that could be attributed to. We're hearing some different ideas. And right now we're also going to talk about another story right now. Out today, a state task force released a report on rural schools. Steve, what are they recommending?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that, and again, this was chaired by a representative from Rhinelander, I do believe. And I think the most important thing that they're bringing up is that all schools are not equal. They maybe produce the same product at the end of the day, but the needs and the demands of rural schools in Wisconsin, they are suffering. And those schools are really under terrific stress. And I guess broadly, they're asking for more flexibility with issues like teacher certification. In other words, if you have to have a chemistry teacher and a biology teacher and a physics teacher, and they all have to have certification, that's a challenging thing for a rural district that maybe just has one physics section or one bio section. So that's one thing that they're looking for. Their transportation costs are huge. They transport such long distances. And then they're also, they are particularly hamstrung by budget cuts. And here's a way for anybody to kind of think about it. They have, relative to larger districts, pretty small budgets. So a 10% cut in districts across the state dramatically affects a smaller budget more than a larger budget because they don't have that much room to spread it around. So rural districts are looking for funding relief and perhaps some breaks in the funding formula to get some more money for them. But the needs are not the same with urban and suburban districts. And this task force tried to bring that out. So they should be commended for that.
And this is not an apolitical issue. There has been some Democratic pushback, particularly against the idea of giving some teachers a pass on recertification. But overall, Steve, what do you make about this? Does this seem to make sense to you?
I think it makes tremendous sense. I realize all things are political, if you like Polybius, if anybody remembers being awake for that in class. But, you know, here's a way to think about it. In the United States, we have about 50 million school children, just broadly speaking. Did you know what that 50 million, 25 to 30% of those are students that attend a rural school district? That is a huge percent of the population. We used to have maybe 70 years ago about 120,000 school districts in the United States. We have barely over 13,000 now. So school districts have become fewer in number, but we still have students in rural areas. And those districts are trying desperately to survive. but they don't want to just survive. They want their students to thrive. So they know that they need flexibility to meet those needs, and that's what they're trying to do. Now, politically, though, we have a representative democracy and not a geographic one. So more land doesn't equal more power, unless you're watching the TV show Dallas, I guess, or Bonanza. But this isn't the way it works. So they don't have the political oomph. And this task force did have some Republicans and Democrats, and so they're trying to bring these issues forward. And that really is a good thing, because it's not apples and apples. They really do have different challenges.
Well, what about you? Are you in a rural school district? Are your children, as a parent, as a teacher, as an administrator, what challenges do you face? And which challenges may be distinct from someone in an urban school district? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And the legislature is not in session right now, not likely to take any of these up until I think I heard January. What do you think will happen then?
Well, you know, it's interesting because this is an issue that is uniquely suited for government intervention. And here's a classic case in that. Historically, when there has been a need that the private market isn't really able to address, now, this could be broadly anything from rural free delivery. RFD was not just an acronym on a short-lived Mayberry TV show in the 60s, but the government needed to provide rural free delivery for mail. Well, we have a different need in the North Woods of Wisconsin, and it's broadband fiber optic connectivity for the Internet. There's not enough profit for individual companies to come in, and it does seem uniquely suited for the government to come in and with subsidies and encouragement or just to enact this and bring this about, because rural districts can't even offer a lot of distance education classes because they don't even have the Internet connectivity to have it be live and interactive and reflect current technological advances. But we don't currently have a government in Madison that looks upon that initiative favorably. So that's why politically some of these Republican Congress or assembly members have really, I think, responded to their local constituents and deserve credit for bringing this up. But the private market isn't going to address this. Boy, if you look at a representative south of Route 29 and east of Interstate 39, this just really isn't on their radar. It's not that much of an issue for them. Large portions of the state need help, and whether it's funding formula, Internet access, transportation subsidies, and we're really having this mix, or not this mix, but this dichotomy in the state, and politically, they just don't have the power to get it up, and hopefully this task force will at least get the conversation started in a serious way.
Steve, is this likely to pit rural school districts against urban school districts? Obviously, urban districts facing challenges of their own, there may be things they would like tweaked, funding formulas and such. What do you think could happen as that plays out down the road?
Well, and we have seen in education in Wisconsin, it is a zero-sum game. And on top of that now, we have the voucher system pulling money out of this finite budget. I guess all budgets are finite. But we have others coming in now and extracting resources from the education budget in Wisconsin. And now rural schools are saying, hey, our needs are different. We need more money for transportation. We need some relaxation from certification issues. We need some things. And boy, you know, I'd have to say their needs are terrifically legitimate and valuable and important. But politically and economically, you've got to wonder where the capital is going to come from to address their needs and get what they want, which was, I believe sort of the response the Democrats said, this doesn't go far enough, their needs are even greater. Legitimate, but boy, at least this got brought on the front burner for today.
Well, I want to go back and revisit our first topic here as we wrap up this interview. William from Madison says he believes a large reason for the failing achievement levels in our cities is due to lack of adequate parenting skills. We need to, as a community, address the issue of parents who love their children but are impaired in their parenting practices. Now, this referring back to the stagnating math and reading scores in high school seniors found nationally. What do you think about this?
Well, I think that one can take a sociological approach to it. And certainly we know that if your parents graduated from high school, the odds are overwhelming you were going to graduate from high school. If you speak English at home, they speak English at school, you're going to do better than students who don't speak English at home. And if your parents graduated from college, then your chances are you're going to graduate from college. So there are many predictors along the way that we know that fall into place. I would say that before we might start looking at what we might tentatively decide as parenting practices that some of us are different from others, we have to look at this opportunity gap that exists and how these children enter school and maintain their interest and value and importance of education. And so if those things hold consistent, students will do well. So the school structure has to be in such a way that we encourage students, we don't give up on students, we meet the students' needs, we don't assume it's one size fits all. So I think that to blame a parenting style might be not where we want to start, and there are many more positive, productive things that we can be aware of with how schools are structured that will result in positive incomes. And Madison has recently announced some of those, a parenting initiative, a way to be able to welcome parents into schools, a way to be able to set up expectations for parents to come into schools, and then you're establishing a community of learning. And those are the ways you make positive long-term changes.
We'll leave it there. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today.
Always happy to be here. WPR is one of the best things about Wisconsin.
We love to hear that. Well, that was Steve Correa, an associate professor of education at St. Norbert College.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up in a few minutes, the 1990s saw predictions of the rise of a super predator class of criminals in the United States, and laws were based on those predictions. Our guest takes a look back at what happened next.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Each spring, ramps inspire the breathless praise and devotion of foodies and foragers. Writer Brett Laidlaw explains why he loves this wild edible.
There's been an amazing surge of interest in foraging in the last few years, an avid new focus on very old foods. If this movement had a poster child, it would probably be the ramp. If you are hip to that scene, I don't have to tell you that by ramp, I don't mean the way we get on and off the freeway in our cars, but rather a native plant often called a wild leek. The ascendance of the ramp from backcountry subsistence food to a starring role on gourmet menus is truly remarkable. As one of the earliest edible plants to emerge in the spring, ramps have been celebrated in seasonal festivals for decades. They're most commonly associated with the Appalachian region, but they're found throughout the eastern and central U.S. The most often remarked upon feature of ramps is their aroma, to put it nicely. The leaves produce a powerful garlic onion smell. One nickname is the King of Stink, and the scent has been described as like fried green onions with a dash of funky feet. How a food with such a homely appeal became prized by gourmets is a bit of a mystery. Around 15 years ago, I started seeing mention of this exciting new ingredient in restaurant reviews. Then they showed up in the stores where a small bunch cost around $5. When I literally stumbled upon them while hiking beside a trout stream one May day, I was brought up short by the pungent aroma drifting up from the leaves crushed by my wading boots. Looking around me then, I saw that I stood in a sea of ramps, the dark green, spear-shaped leaves dotted here and there with bluebells or yellow marsh marigolds. With a free source at my disposal, I began to experiment and found that ramps are as versatile as they are assertive. At their base, there's a gently swelling white bulb, which can be used just as an onion or leek. They can be chopped and sautéed, left whole to grill or braise. They make a nice pickle, too. The leaves can be chopped, added at the end of cooking, or made into a distinctive pesto. In certain parts of the country, the ramp's popularity has worked against them. Seemingly inexhaustible patches have been nearly wiped out. Ramps grow in clumps that can take a decade to reach mature size, and careless harvesting destroys their ability to reproduce. With our wintry spring, ramps are late to appear this year. But eventually, the sun will warm the chill forest floor, and I'll pick a bluebird day to make my way to my secret patch. I'll come home with a sack of ramps redolent of springtime renewal, and I'll use them in just about every meal until they're done for the season. By mid-June, the leaves yellow and then wither. The other wildflowers overtake them, and where once there was a vast plain of ramps, now you'd never know they grew there at all. It's that ephemeral quality that makes me treasure them, spring after spring.
Brett Laidlaw is the author of the cookbook and blog Trout Caviar. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Find more Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television. The new series airs Monday at 8 o'clock. The 1990s saw predictions of a rising class of young, violent criminals, and sociologists predicted that those criminals would spark a massive rise in violent crime.
A new video from The Retro Report looks back at the rise and fall of the super predator. Here's a clip.
There's a tidal wave of juvenile violent crime right over the horizon.
And some who study it say the worst is yet to come.
Life in the 1990s was dominated by a sense that youth violence was out of control. The future looked bleak. To explain why, one word said it all.
Super predators.
Bonnie Bertram joins us now. She's a producer for the Retro Report. They do an ongoing video series looking at past stories and updating them. Their goal, the truth now about the big stories then. Bonnie, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Nice to be here.
Well, remembering the 90s, that really was the scene. Why were we so worried about youth violence in the mid-1990s?
Well, I think a lot of it started with that high-profile case of the woman who had been raped in Central Park. And people now, we know, erroneously thought that a bunch of teens who had been quote-unquote wilding had gone after her. And then several years later, a lot of your listeners being in Wisconsin might remember that in Chicago it was a really bad summer. In late summer, two brothers, a 14-year-old and a 16-year-old, killed a fellow gang member who was 10, who had himself shot another young woman by accident. And then that was followed up just a few weeks later with the tragic death of Eric Morse, who was 5, and who was dropped out of an apartment, an empty apartment building window, because he refused to sell candy for some other boys. So I think people had just felt like there was this constant drumbeat of horrendous crimes and kids who were so young, and they just felt a sense of weariness and exasperation, and they felt like, when will this end and what are we going to do to stop it?
And where did the concept of the super predator come from?
Well, there is a political scientist professor at Princeton University named John DiIulio, who had done a lot of work in prisons, and he had studied crime even though his forte was political science. And he had done a lot of sort of on-the-ground research, and he said that, you know, he would go in and talk to these prisoners who had done terrible things, but that the juvenile populations were terrifying to him. And one older prisoner he talked to said, these young guys coming in today, they're stone-cold predators. So Professor DiIulio and some of his cohorts, who were also criminologists and sociologists, looked at a bunch of data and from the Census Bureau and crime statistic forecasts. And they thought, oh, my gosh, this is just the beginning of a wave of kids who are going to be even more violent, and they're going to be more in number. And he wrote an article for the then-nascent Weekly Standard magazine, and he talked about stone-cold predators. And he mentioned it in the text, and his editor realized that was a very catchy media topic, and so that became the title of the piece, The Coming of the Super Predator. Mm.
And this concept caught on, and then there were predictions from John DiIulio and others that crime was going to boom because of these super predators.
he had a great line. He said, you don't have to worry about finding yourself in a bad neighborhood. The bad neighborhood's coming to you. He really has a knack with words and talked about this group of kids who are fatherless and godless, and just that they were remorseless, that they had no compunction or second thoughts about the kind of killing sprees that they were going to go on.
What ended up actually happening in the crime rates after these predictions?
Well, that's the curious thing. So his article comes out in 1995, just about the same time that juvenile crime rates inexplicably start dropping precipitously. And even today, nobody knows really what to attribute that drop to. But it was a stunning reversal. He said that he thought the crime rate was going to double and then double again. And in fact, it dropped. So he was off by at least a factor of four.
And in this edition of Retro Report, you talked to him and some other academics who'd made similar predictions. What, looking back now, what are they saying about what they thought and said then?
Well, it's really interesting. And, you know, a lot of times you interview college professors and, you know, they sort of stay on script. But we took a long time to get Professor Giulio to talk with us. He's now at University of Pennsylvania now. And I have to say that it was really pretty commendable that he... You know, he was what you'd call sort of a public intellectual. He didn't want to just sit around in his ivory tower and write a white paper or an abstract like, wow, look at this. You know, we're all going to be in, we're all doomed. He felt compelled that he really had to go out and sound the alarm bell. So sort of to his credit, he and a couple of other of his colleagues who had the same concern, one of them being Alan Fox at Northeastern University, went out and talked to the media and wrote articles, and, you know, the people were eager to assign blame to this group of kids, and they wanted that abstract fear that they had to sort of, it gave a place for that abstract fear to sort of live. So when he found out that the crime rate was wrong, it became a really interesting psychological profile of what happens when a public intellectual puts themselves out there in the arena of sort of public opinion, and then what do they do when they're wrong? And I think it took a lot of courage. I mean, there were a lot of terrible results of what he did, but I also think it took a lot of courage for him to say, you know what, I was wrong. And not only was he wrong, Rob, but he signed an amicus brief. The juvenile justice sentencing laws were challenged before the Supreme Court in 2010 as being too draconian, too harsh on kids. And he signed the amicus brief that I did a search in the brief, and I think like 72 times the name Super Predator comes up. And every time it's mentioned as this terrible aspect that was erroneously named, you know, it completely trashes the whole Super Predator notion. And then he said, you know what, I'm going to sign that. So it was pretty, it was a pretty incredible turnaround.
Well, Bonnie, thanks for tracking the story back to then and now, and thanks for joining us today.
Sure, my pleasure. Check us out at retroreport.org.
Yeah, that was Bonnie Bertram, producer with Retro Report, and we've got a link to the full video of this report on super predators over at the Central Time Facebook page that'll take you over to that video and other videos at Retro Report.